Ladies and gentlemen, señores y señoras, bienvenidos, welcome. Thank you for joining us this morning and choosing this panel over what I know is going to be another glorious day in Aspen. We hope that we will reward you with a great intellectual discussion, and I'm confident with the panelists that we have that we can pull that off. So my name is Randall Kempner. I am the executive director of the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs. That is a policy program at the Aspen Institute that focuses on trying to drive entrepreneurial support strategies in emerging markets. Essentially, we're a network of organizations that support small and growing business entrepreneurs in developing countries as a mechanism to drive prosperity and as an alternative to some of the other development approaches that you've seen going on for years. Today, what we're going to talk about with the panel is market-based approaches to poverty reduction in Latin America. And before I go into much more detail, let me share with you who you are going to hear from today. The first to my far right is Gustavo Arnavat. He is the U.S. Executive Director of the Inter-American Development Bank. That is the largest multilateral financial institution that focuses on Latin America and the Caribbean. There are 48 member country shareholders. And it provides a variety of different types of finance to support economic development and poverty reduction in emerging markets. Gustavo has a background as a lawyer and a banker. He's worked at Citigroup and Morgan Stanley and a whole variety of other places. Next to him is another banker by trade, Willie Foote. He's the CEO and founder of Root Capital, which is a social investment fund that supports grassroots businesses in emerging markets, focuses specifically on providing capital and technical assistance to rural areas. As I said, he is a banker. He also is a journalist by training and has been living and working throughout Latin America for many years. To my left is Ricardo Salinas. He is the president of Grupo Salinas, which is one of the largest conglomerates in all of the Americas. It includes banking, television, telecom, retail. In addition to his core business areas, Ricardo is very involved in sort of cultural and social support organizations throughout Mexico, including those that support entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial development. To his left is Ricardo Terán. Ricardo, Salinas is a business person, though I think it's safe to say, Ricardo, that your businesses have not quite grown in size as much as Grupo Salinas. There's time, right? He is a business person by training and is the co-founder and managing partner of Agora Partnerships, which is a nonprofit based in Nicaragua, which promotes entrepreneurship by providing lending support as well as technical assistance. They also have an investment fund, so there's kind of a for-profit and a nonprofit element to Ricardo's business. So what we want to talk about today is alternative approaches to poverty reduction. And there's sort of two pieces of this that we'll get into. One is this question of whether or not the present approaches have been working, and you know, sort of the panelist's perspective on whether the aid system as we know it today makes sense. And then the second would be to sort of really go into some new models that have emerged that are represented by the individuals on this panel. So by way of a little bit of background, if we look at Latin America today, or in 2008, according to World Bank figures, there were approximately 100 million people in Latin America that lived in extreme poverty, defined as $2.50 or $2.50 a day of income. So 100 million people, that's about 20% of the population. For the Americans in the group, that's as if all of Texas, New York, and California lived in extreme poverty and had access or had difficulty in accessing food and the daily needs of their lives. And that's actually an improvement. I guess that's the good news of the day. 10, 15 years ago, it was more like 120 million. But regardless, I think it's pretty clear that most people believe that we have not succeeded in solving and really addressing the poverty challenges in those countries. And increasingly, those people who are focused on the role of aid agencies have become more and more disenchanted with the efforts that U.S. and international aid, which totals about $7 billion a year to Latin America, has not had the impact that it wants. So I want to read a quote from Dambisa Moyo, who wrote a book called Dead Aid. Many of you, I suspect, have heard of that book. How many of you have read Dead Aid in the crowd? Okay, so not as well known perhaps in this crowd as it is in the development community, but it caused quite a splash, and you can see why when I read this quote. She writes, "The notion that aid can alleviate systemic poverty and has done so is a myth. Millions in Africa are poor today because of aid. Misery and poverty have not ended but increased. Aid has been and continues to be an unmitigated political, economic, and humanitarian disaster for most parts of the developing world." So, Gustavo, you're not an aid agency, but you're as close as we've got here on the panel. Is the aid system as we see it today broken? Should we start from scratch? Or is Ms. Moyo being a little bit hyperbolic here?
Well, I guess as I'm a member of the administration, I have to be extremely careful what I say, especially as it may reflect on other parts of the U.S. government, particularly the State Department, USAID, who I think have been doing a very good job. They deal with the immediate needs of the poor, and therefore have a role to play. I think the problem with providing that kind of aid in general, without being specific with respect to any particular program, is that over the long run, it's not sustainable. And that's why I think that market-based solutions are the way to go. It might surprise some people in the audience, since I was appointed by President Obama, that my prejudice coming from the business side, and I know the president's prejudice and other people in Treasury, is that we think that it's the private sector that must provide the vast majority, will provide the vast majority of jobs, not only in this country, but in other countries. And so it's important to support the private sector. And certainly that is also the philosophy at the IDB and has been, especially over the last 10 to 15 years, and will continue to be. We just, and the United States was at the forefront of pushing through the largest capital increase in the history of the IDB from a capital base of about $100 billion to $170 billion. And that will allow a doubling of funding from what it was in, say, the last 10 years or 12 years going forward the next 10 to 15 years, whenever there might be another need for capital increase, or hopefully there won't be. But the important thing is that part of that and something that we pushed for was an increase in funds to be made available through the various private sector windows of the bank. From right now, the limit, which is about 10% of outstanding loans, to quite frankly an unlimited amount, subject to capital adequacy model and asset and liability management policy that we have in place, namely that we want to keep our AAA rating. So this will provide a lot of funding for the private sector, both directly as well as indirectly. That is, giving funds, to governments to help streamline, make more efficient business registration processes, et cetera, all with the aim of helping private business. I will say that there are instances where the bank must continue to provide almost the equivalent of aid. We have a concessional window through which the poorest countries in the region receive financing. Countries like Bolivia, Honduras, for example, basically at no cost to them. They do have to repay the loan. One special case is Haiti, and we all know what's been happening in Haiti. Not only recently, we know the history of Haiti for the last 200 years or so. The bank has been in Haiti 50 years, will continue to be there for a long time, unfortunately. But we are in the process of forgiving almost net present value, $500 million in loans to Haiti, and we'll be providing $200 million per year for the next 10 years in grants. In that case, we think it's inevitable we have to provide grants. But even then, certain programs, which I can talk about later within the Multilateral Investment Fund, are aimed at helping private entrepreneurs in Haiti to develop business models and to thrive and survive.
Great. So, Willie, is Dambisa right or wrong?
I think she's wrong in so much as I think that the system is not entirely obsolete. It has huge shortcomings and needs to be rebooted, not scratched. So my main beefs with the current kind of the status quo would be, first, that too many development projects are cooked up in Washington, D.C. or Brussels or wherever, and that they are pushed top-down on recipients, and that they are heavy on overhead and they're lean on local ownership and accountability. Second beef would be that there are too many vertical investments, and not sufficient horizontal integration of those vertical investments. So you get these crazy siloed projects and projects that are disarticulated and redundant to each other in the exact same region. We see that a lot in our work at Root Capital on the ground. And the third would be, I think there's a desperate need for the Obama administration to kind of straighten out the spaghetti bowl of conflicting responsibilities and mandates of the different development agencies that currently comprise our toolkit for fighting global poverty. So how do you study and fix that org chart, get those different agencies to actually talk to each other in a robust way, and maybe unite them behind a shared vision of fighting global poverty through a market-based kind of sustainable capitalism model? And then if you do that, maybe you can get the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs and Andy to suggest things like creating an SBA, a Small Business Administration for the base of the pyramid, that is regionally run and smartly and efficiently operated, and that might support and coordinate public and private investments of money and expertise to kind of accelerate entrepreneurship in developing countries. I think that's, to conclude for us, my headline here is that in our work at Root Capital, I think the most important role of aid and government, or government aid and traditional charity, is addressing the need for public goods like financial education or enabling environment that sit along functioning markets. And to the extent a government is unwilling or unable to provide those public goods, or it's inappropriate or unrealistic for a for-profit company to do so, then I think aid and philanthropy can step in and play a role, and a very important role, to kind of keep those markets functioning.
Thanks, Willie. So, Ricardo Salinas, you're a well-established business person. You run some industries or some organizations which are as large as some of these aid agencies. What's your perspective?
Well, first, about the aid, I think we should look at it in terms of two different objectives, a short-term objective and a longer-term one. For the short-term, and for any aid, thank you. We all appreciate whatever wealthy and well-meaning countries do for the less fortunate. So first, thanks in order. But we have to distinguish. When you have a crisis like the earthquake in Haiti, or when you have horrible floods like we have now in Mexico, that kind of aid is highly useful and sought after. But even that aid should not be channeled through the government channels because of the tremendous inefficiency and corruption. And that's a worldwide phenomenon. Mexico and Latin America do not have the monopoly on government inefficiency. It's all across. So that aid should be channeled through NGOs, non-government agencies. But it's, again, this is the short type of aid, the short-term type of aid. We look at this like that proverb that says, you got to give a man a fish or teach him how to fish. And obviously, if he's starving and it touches your heart, you give him a fish. But that's not the long-term solution. It's much better to teach him to fish and then lend him some money for a fishing pole, and teach him to tie some fishing hooks and knots and whatever. Also, he has to be healthy, otherwise he can't move and go fishing. So we move on to the longer-term part, and I see three things that we need to have if we really want to have a long-term sustainable productivity based on investment in jobs. Three things. Number one, human capital. At the end of the day, it's all about education and what the person does with his person and his life. Second, we need to have a good environment because we take it for granted, but the infrastructure, the correct incentives, they're not there. And very, very important, the regulation. All our Latin countries share the same commonality from history, which is inheritance from Spain. It's very bad in terms of business. It's very, very bad. We have inherited some very good things from Spain. But in terms of the legal structure, the regulatory structure, the judicial process, it's terrible. So you cannot overemphasize the adverse impact that wrong regulation has on jobs, job creation, investment, and long-term productivity. So that in terms of environment. And then we get to the third point, which is money capital. Many people think that if just with a loan available and giving money to people will be fixed. It's not. It doesn't work like that. So money capital is the last part of achieving long-term sustainable productivity and probably the easiest part to solve. Yep. But really the number two, human capital, health, education, and good environment, infrastructure, incentives, and regulation, those are the ones that we really need to work on.
Ricardo, you want to take a shot at this?
Well, I mean, being from Nicaragua, a developing country that has seen tens of billions of dollars of aid money pumped into it and seeing today's results is absolutely gut-wrenching. However, knowing people both in Washington and on the ground in some of these agencies, these are all incredibly intelligent and well-intentioned people. And many times it's the internal rules and regulations that manage these agencies that prevent them from creating things like private sector partnerships where you bring in some private sector people, NGO people, even religious community leaders into an advisory board to say, well, this is the way it should really be done. I mean, so many times just the design of the aid agency ties people's hands. And trust me that, you know, over the 40 years that aid has been going into developing countries, people who are now looking back are not thinking this is what we intended when things don't go right. So, you know, picking up on Willie's point, where are projects created and how is success measured? Yes, there's too many projects that are being created in Washington, D.C. and in Brussels, but even at the local agency level, you need, in our opinion, really both for-profit and non-profit entrepreneurs to step in, because entrepreneurs fundamentally understand about you know, being scrappy and getting things done as efficiently and cheaply as possible, having to go out and mobilize all kinds of resources, both financial and not financial, to get things done. And many times entrepreneurs and aid agencies are not even talking, and when they are, sometimes the incentives are completely different. And going towards a success measurement, you know, In our day-to-day business, it's very easy to see our bottom line results at the end of every quarter, at the end of every year. There's now all these social metrics that we can measure, and it's very, very measurable. But some of these aid projects that are tackling some of the most difficult human and social issues in our countries have to have a very long-term view. I mean, you're trying to put in the case of Nicaragua, 1 million school-age children that are out of the system. That takes time. The results will be seen after time. You have forces within the aid agencies that are pulling it one way. You have political processes within the country that are pulling it another way. And, you know, you have institutions like the Inter-American Development Bank where a lot, and even USAID, and other European aid agencies, where a lot of that aid effort is trying to be coordinated through the government. And I think Don Ricardo already elaborated on that. The other point I would make is about, you know, let's take a step back from aid and let's think about resource allocation. Okay, in business, we say, well, we have a set number of resources. There are other resources that we can mobilize, but it's about scale and it's about risk. And in the business context, there is an imminent feedback loop. People buy your product or they don't buy your product. You raise more money or you don't raise more money. In this development sector, even entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs like Willie, like myself, not always those feedback mechanisms are included. So when you look at, you're trying to scale so that every, you know, I don't want to dehumanize this, but every marginal unit of return on development, you need it to get less expensive, so you need to scale, and then you're taking certain kinds of risks. You need subsidized capital. Well, that seems to me to be the perfect place where aid should be. Putting subsidized capital in the hands of social and for-profit entrepreneurs that have to respond to these market forces to be able to scale and continually grow.
And so if I could try to summarize a little bit what I think you're hearing from the panel and what I think the discussion is now in Washington that I hang out in, is that look, not all aid is bad. There will always be a need for some sorts of charity where you're literally giving grants. Mm-hmm. However, that has been the overarching mechanism, the overarching tool for aid, which has been to give grants. And now there is this understanding, this growing understanding, that if you're going to have a sustainable development outcome, you have to think about how you can actually support market-based approaches, companies that actually will address social and environmental challenges, or nonprofits that have a market-based strategy which has some discipline to it. So there's this kind of growing sense that that's the way to go. And I'll play off of what Ricardo has said. You know, it used to be, right, that it was about giving away the fish. You know, now everyone sort of gets the fact that it's teaching the men and women to fish. But what I want to explore is that increasingly, and you use the term, you kind of hid the word, it's lending the man the fishing pole, not giving it to him, but lending it. And so let me start with you, Gustavo, with this. You know, how do you kind of create a system in which you shift away from the old approach to one which is absolutely embedding market-based approaches in all elements of what we're doing from an aid perspective?
Well, let me just say that there's, I think, smart grants and stupid grants, right? And the stupid grants are the ones that you just simply give the money away, no conditions. You sort of roll the dice and you hope for the best. The smart ones are the ones where you recognize that some entities or governments, even NGOs, don't even have the capacity to pay back a loan. You want to encourage the kind of behavior that would be and practices that would be created by providing the financing. And so you structure a grant program in such a way where that the aid is provided subject to them doing certain things in the way that you specify, but working very closely with them. I just want to push back a little bit about what was said earlier about so much being engineered out of Washington. Certainly a lot of it is. I can only speak for the IDB. We have 26 offices in each of the borrowing countries. We work very closely with the governments, as Ricardo said, Ricardo Tadan. We went through a restructuring at the bank, realignment about 2 or 3 years ago, that caused about half the employees basically to be locally situated. And I was in a meeting about a month ago with Evo Morales, a small meeting with a number of executive directors visiting. The head of the office for Bolivia was there, and Evo turned to him and said, and by the way, this gentleman here, as far as I'm concerned, is almost like a member of my cabinet. And that's how important that person is. That's how important the IDB is locally, and how we really work very, very closely with the local governments. Now, and then also push back a little bit on the corruption issue. Corruption is huge everywhere. It certainly has been very large in Latin America. But there's corruption, everywhere in society, and perhaps it's not called corruption in the private sector. It might be called, cronyism. But there's a lot of that going on as well. My hope is that over time, as governments become more democratic, they'll be more held more accountable. And that's not just a dream. That's something I think we're moving towards. Companies come and go. The state, I think, will always be there. And one of the things that we do at the IDB is make sure that any loans, any grants that we give to governments, that it's done so in a very transparent way. And by doing so, we are, and maybe we're imposing this from Washington, but so be it. We're causing these governments to be less corrupt, I think, over time. And so I think that the overall message that I want to leave is that you can structure even grants in such a way that help help develop markets. I'm thinking of a program, for example, in Haiti that we developed before the earthquake, trying to develop tourism in Haiti. Haiti, from what I understand, some of the best beaches are on the northern side. Trying to encourage, and some cruise ships will stop for a few hours, but there really wasn't a whole lot to do. And so we actually help working with local artisans. It's a time-consuming process. Local artisans to create these arts and crafts fairs, so that when the ships would come in for the 3 or 4 hours, local businesses and artisans would have something to sell. And that's something that probably would not have happened because of the market failures in Haiti, were it not for the Multilateral Investment Fund that to come in and provide those grants. No expectations, obviously, that they would be repaid. But those are smart grants. And the hope is that over time, a sustainable market will develop in that part of Haiti.
So, Will, you and Root Capital have sort of taken this general message to heart and have developed a model which seems to be working pretty well throughout Latin America. Maybe you could talk briefly about what the model is and how you're integrating both philanthropic capital and capital that's at risk to support small businesses.
Yeah, so our model is we have a three-pronged strategy. It's finance, advise, catalyze. We provide capital to businesses that are locked out of the banking system for lack of traditional collateral and other constraints. We largely focus on small farmer cooperatives, associations, agricultural entrepreneurs, artisan associations, and we're tightly integrated into the global value chains of sustainable natural product industries. So think Starbucks and Whole Foods and Marks and Spencers, and we basically lend in the absence of hard collateral. We lend against forward contracts and purchase orders with those buyers, and we've done about $200 million in credit in the past number of years and have a 99% repayment rate. But these are really tough markets, so we raise capital where we can, in effect, do the R&D for the finance industry, for the financial services industry, to prove the business case for lending into these rural markets where really very few banks will work these days, and indeed microfinancial institutions are not reaching. And so we're saying, okay, we're going to build a really robust monitoring system. We're going to send our investment officers 14 hours up and over the Andes to the Peruvian jungle to do hardcore tire kicking on the businesses. But little by little, we're going to build off-the-shelf banking products that will crowd in local financial institutions. But it's going to take some time for us to hit threshold scale to achieve sustainability and deliver on our mission in perpetuity. So we're going to ask for investors, impact investors, to take a bit of a haircut on financial return, maybe get a 2 or 3% return, but they certainly get their money back, and we wrap that in very tight social and environmental metrics. So we're basically saying do that and kickstart private markets, and over time Root Capital works itself out of a job. So that's kind of on the lending side. And again, the DNA in the organization, I think any organization like ourselves, is it's all about proving the business case so that the local private markets might have done this 20 or 50 years from now, we'll do it in 5 years, and you're accelerating, and that's the justification for the smart subsidy. As opposed to masking our inefficiencies, it's helping us to address market failures. Now, quickly on the other side, about halfway through our 10-year journey, we realized that one of the many public goods that need to sit alongside the capital because of deep market failures, which might include, as Ricardo said, not just capital, but managerial talent, and network knowledge and technology and markets and so on, we decided what we could do really well because of our acumen in kind of co-op finances and rural enterprise financials was to do financial education. And that's entirely philanthropically funded now, but the idea is that, with a relatively light touch, and indeed with funding from the IDB and the Multilateral Investment Fund, we started out, that we would build, in this essence, a nascent MBA in finance for rural business leaders so that folks with little to no formal education but are out there making it happen in the trenches can better compete in world markets. So bookkeeping, how to reconcile accounts, how to create and maintain reliable cash flow statements, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't want to be a kind of a jack of all trades, but we feel very strongly that you have to recognize that kind of smart subsidy can and must sit alongside functioning markets to be able to address what are indeed deep market failures that are a result of not a two-year recession, but decades and decades of underinvestment and neglect and the failure of public and private markets to meet basic needs of people in Latin America and beyond.
So, Ricardo Terán, you have a similar focus but a different model, working in Nicaragua, which is one of the most impoverished countries. So one of the questions that I suspect the audience is thinking is, well, this sounds really good, but can it really work in a place where you don't have a lot of entrepreneurs and you don't have strong markets? So what's your thought?
Correctly identifying entrepreneurs and defining and understanding who are entrepreneurs and who are not has been an incredibly difficult challenge. And, you have micro entrepreneurs that, their entrepreneurial enterprise is their form of sustainability, necessity entrepreneurs. And then you have entrepreneurs of opportunity. And what we have seen and we've evolved over time is that we need to, identify and find those entrepreneurs of opportunity who have some background and some track record, as small as it can be, to try and scale their venture to have a larger impact. That basically leaves some of the more micro entrepreneurs out of our model. But even these entrepreneurs that we identify, you know, we're asking a lot from them. We're asking them to develop a business in an incredibly difficult environment, but also a business that would generate jobs and have social impact. So we have built a whole series of tools and technical assistance mechanisms completely through subsidized donations to try and help accelerate these entrepreneurs. Now our accelerator project is trying to scale, and we're forming the partnerships to take it to the other countries of Central America so that we can identify a network of up to 500 entrepreneurs throughout Central America that are growing their businesses, that we can help grow their business through mentoring and management training, helping them build these management teams, centralizing some of the transactional issues that a business of a micro scale does not have, cannot efficiently do. And then can we tie that into the financing? So we will bring the impact investors, including our own micro venture capital fund, to participate throughout the process, which will reduce the transaction cost for investors to find these kinds of deals, and to try and place money in entrepreneurs that already have some kind of stamp of approval because they've gone through a vetted system where you understand that they can grow. Now, one important issue is many times when we refer to development, the concept of benchmarking, especially when it's using business for development, the concept of benchmarking is not always that clear. If we analyze the venture capital industry in the world's most dynamic venture capital market in Silicon Valley, if we can reduce it to very simple terms, more or less, you know, a very, very small percentage, maybe even 1% of the entrepreneurs who need venture capital get venture capital. We have to understand what some of these standards are, because when these new market-based approaches are coming to fruition, especially when you're taking nonprofit dollars, donation dollars, into an area like investing in these kinds of entrepreneurs, sometimes the measurements aren't equal. So they'll say to you, well, you only funded 30% of the entrepreneurs. That's a very low number. But in fact, we're trying to use technical assistance to develop these entrepreneurs further, and actually 30% is 300 times more than a similar benchmark in a similar industry. So this is it's not easy work at all, and it is quite expensive because there is a whole failure rate that is normal in any business anyway. We're just using some subsidized capital to do it.
Okay. So Ricardo Salinas, you're the big businessman on the panel. Many would say that, look, the answer to this is we just need to build supply chains. Mm-hmm. You know, we love Root Capital, we love Agoda, and some of you are actually doing this, but the real answer is not NGOs and intermediaries, it's having businesses that are actively looking for, or just because they need them, they find small business entrepreneurs who can supply the bigger businesses. So I'm interested in your perspective on that, and whether we're at a place where these entrepreneurs actually exist, where some of the larger enterprises that you operate would be able to leverage them?
Well, there's a lot of entrepreneurs around in our country, a lot. There's literally millions of people just going out every day trying to make a living. So we must not underestimate them. When we started Banco Azteca in 8 years ago, 2002, nobody thought that this bank would have any chance of growing because it was a bank that was targeted to the bottom of the pyramid. Well, today we have 8 million loans outstanding. 8 million people with a loan. And the average loan is about $300. So who could have thought about that kind of number? And, of course, many of these, I'd say about 60% of them, are for personal loans that can be taken out to remodel your home, to start your own business, for a medical emergency. You know, that kind of loan. But we really don't know the effect of this on development, but because it has not been measured. But I think that people are not stupid. They know what they're doing with their money. And we should trust them much more than any agency as to what they're doing with that money. So in that respect, I feel very proud to be able to have facilitated this kind of flow of funds into society. Now, when you're making loans, you have to be very careful to make a distinction. Is it a real loan with terms and time and interest rate, and it has to be repaid. And if it's not repaid, does it have consequences? That's a real loan. And then there's, we call them soft loans. And they can vary from a make-believe loan where you make believe that you have to pay, but you really don't, or a less make-believe loan, but still a soft loan, where instead of paying a 50% interest rate, you're going to pay a 10% interest rate. And it's a subsidy. Yes. And instead of paying it in 18 months, you're going to be able to pay it in 60 months. And that's a subsidy, too. When you're doing this kind of thing, if you're going to make subsidized loans, and many people do, it's a good idea, by the way. I'd rather have a subsidized loan than a giveaway. People will value that much more. But if you're going to be in the subsidized loan business, you're still in the loan business. And what that means is you still have to originate the loans with criteria. It's not, you know, how do you give them a loan? Because somebody raised his hand? You know what you're saying? No, you have to have a criteria to originate. You need business processes to do that. And then you need to have, again, a management for collections and just running the portfolio. So that requires a lot of know-how. And it's not easy, because that's the real part of a bank.
Will, you got some know-how.
I just want to jump in with one comment, just to compliment all the comments around kind of the individual retail lending or technical assistance to businesses, which I think in the context of how does traditional aid and charity mix with market-based solutions, I think that's critically important, but something that we certainly recognize every single day, and certainly any entrepreneur on the ground would, is that I think aid and charity and market need to play a role in addressing the externalities. That really, without them being addressed, you cannot have small and growing business sector, for instance, that can be competitive in the marketplace. So is government investing in transport and energy and education? Are they maintaining roads to get product at cost out of Chiapas, Mexico, yes, and be competitive? Are they investing in rural energy for communities that are off-grid? Is there any way to acquire workforce skills as an entrepreneur? Corruption, as you mentioned, is a huge issue. And if you're not, as a government, paying, you know, government employees, i.e. police and military, what happens often? They literally set up roadblocks to charge bribes, and that creates a barrier for. And then in case of lending for us, and I know a lot of these issues have probably been addressed because of enlightened business leaders like Ricardo, but often it's not about just the bank not having the market knowledge, to do cash flow value chain finance. It's that there are regulatory constraints that keep you from using cash flow or purchase orders.
Exactly.
So to what extent can aid and traditional charity address those issues in addition to the retail issues that individual businesses need around technical assistance and capital? I don't know, but they're super important questions, and we can never forget both sides. And lastly, just I think that's one of the important reasons why Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs, on which Ricardo and I are on the board and Randall runs, is basically back to the kind of, it's not about giving a man or woman to fish, it's not about teaching a fish, it's about changing the whole damn fishing industry. And the only way you can do that as a retail little rinky-dink shop like Root Capital is to say, we're going to do like what Muhammad Yunus did for microfinance and company, which is create collaborative behavior, unified voice, advocacy platforms to create an entire industry that unlocks billions and billions of dollars. So you can go to the IDB or Minister of Economy and say, I'm speaking to you on behalf of an entire industry block, and these are our policy recommendations.
So I'd like to jump in with this other thing, excuse me, about corruption, and Gustavo mentioned this. My faith in government organizations is very, very low. Because I've been there, and I've faced it. And I'm a powerful guy. And it's been hard for me. Okay. Very hard. So I don't think we can underestimate inefficiency and corruption, which for me are the same thing. But inefficiency is just gross. And it's the same thing. I mean, when people are supposed to do a job and they get paid for it and they don't do it, what is that? Is it corruption or inefficiency? It's the same thing. It's just not getting the job done. So we have to be very careful with the little aid that's available. If you channel it through governments, it's practically a done deal, it will get turned into dust. You've got to be extremely careful. And another thing is, I think Gustavo mentioned a little bit about this, about the state, and that the people change, but the state continues. I disagree with that, because in our countries, the people become the institution. So if you have a guy that's good and he's doing a good job, by all means support him and his institution. But the moment that this guy is kicked out because the power changed, and this happens every 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, this is the way it's done. Then a new guy sits in there. Then all bets are off. Now he has to prove himself, because that institution is nothing without the guy that was doing a good job there at the top. So that's been my experience. And that's why I think that supporting NGOs is a much better idea, because those NGOs do continue after one government and another government and another government. We cannot overemphasize the importance of continuity of people who know and love what they're doing. Yeah. That's my point about the government.
So let's go to Gustavo, and then I'm going to ask one more question to the panel, and then I'm going to go to you guys. So get your questions ready. So Gustavo.
No, just on that point, my concern is a model where you starve government, and by doing so, you're starving not only politicians that some you may like, some you may not like, but you're also starving the civil service. And I think that we should try to nourish the development of the civil service in these countries in such a way that, yes, you have to root out corruption, but you have to have government, right? I know very few, you cannot have chaos, right? The absence of government, if you will. And so it's just something that you have to, it's tough. And Ricardo, I have not been in your position, but I can imagine the frustrations of having to deal with what you have to deal with. But we have to deal with it, and I think we have to try to encourage the formation of strong civil servants, so that regardless of who's in office, 95% of the work that's done in these countries is really done by the civil servants, who are supposed to be experts in their fields. Will, you mentioned something about the importance of government coming in, stepping in with their market failures, and to help streamline regulation, whatever it is. We had a program in Panama back in 2000. Called Compite Panama, where we identified 10 export clusters, including in the coffee sector. And one of the things that we did was focusing on the red tape when it came to exports, and try to help, and we provided technical assistance to the government to help them reduce that red tape. So it was help to the government, ultimately reducing that tape so that exporters could export faster and in a more profitable fashion.
So, drawing on sort of the comments at this point, what we're hearing is that there's sort of this emerging set of programs and policies that are directed at trying to help small business entrepreneurs. But the reality is today that's very small. If you compare it to microfinance, where there's $39 billion of loans outstanding in the world, or private equity finance in emerging markets, where in 2008 there were $67 billion of investment in private equity, at a very optimistic perspective, there are about $7 billion that are being raised or have already been given to small and medium enterprises invested in them in emerging markets. So this whole space is small. And the question that I hope you're all asking, and it's one that I ask all the time, is, well, how the heck do we scale this thing? How does this actually get to be as important as microfinance? And so let me ask the panelists, whoever wants to respond, in as specific way as possible, what needs to be done and who needs to do it to make sure that this isn't just another development program approach that gets tried and failed? Ricardo Terán.
We face this issue every day, and it fundamentally comes down to how do you attack transaction costs so that you can start achieving scale, as well as where can you innovate technologies and approaches to trying to in the loan industry, it's originating the loan and managing the loan. Mm-hmm. Here it's originating the investment and managing these investments, finding exit strategies. On the transaction cost side, it costs the same amount of money to administrate a $50,000 loan or investment as a $5 million loan or investment.
So what does that mean for the interest rate?
Right.
Well, no. Think about it. Because this is a major, major problem. Mm-hmm. Do-gooders mm-hmm. want low interest rates.
Right.
It's fine, you know, low relative to what? And the main problem that we have is regulation that impedes high loans, high rates for small loans. But you touched on the critical subject. If I'm going to make a $300 loan, I have to charge 50% interest. Is that a lot? It's not. It's the absolute best interest rate in the market for that kind of loan. Mm-hmm. But if you compare it with a $300 million loan, now clearly 50% is way too much. And this thing affects our business because regulators say, how can these rich people be charging 50% on the loans?
Right. And I think somewhere where we need to try and innovate to specifically reach this market is also on the kinds of structures in finance that we have. So we've been able to create, we've had some very successful investments where we can loan people money at a reasonable interest rate but have some kind of success fee built into it. So that if our technical assistance actually allows these people to grow, we can get a royalty on sales. So that maybe the effective interest rate is close to 50%. Yeah. But it aligns the interests of both the small business as well as the organization who's providing the technical assistance to really achieve some kind of growth.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Ricardo.
Okay, I'll just continue with my point about how we can really scale this industry or this idea of developing the bottom of the pyramid is start with regulation. You cannot overemphasize the bad effect of well-meaning, badly thought regulation. Because when we started the bank, I'll just give you some examples. We were forced to create a huge file like this for a $300 loan, the same way that the $300,000 home loan was originated. Now, clearly you cannot do that because otherwise there'd be no loans. The fight that we had to make at the Ministry of Finance to just get them to understand that this was a small one and had to treat it differently, number one. Number two, there's many countries still with interest rate caps, with do-gooders are in control and smart in big countries like Colombia, for example. You cannot make a loan over 32% in Colombia. Why? Because that's usury. It's a really bad thing. Well, what that means, in translation, is you cannot make any loan under $3,000. That's the translation. Do we really want that? No. So that kind of thing, the regulatory impact, and especially when these financial institutions are treated as part of the financial system, they really get killed.
But I'd push back, and I'll have Willie help me answer. There are tons of microfinance institutions in the world. Mm-hmm. Despite these regulations, you know, $39 billion, that's a lot of money that's going to in very small amounts. But it's the small businesses, the ones that are the next level up, that might be able to pay 30%, that the money doesn't exist. It's the $30,000 loan, which we're not finding. And I know the IDB is trying to help with this with Opportunities for the Majority Initiative. And Willie, this is kind of the range in which you play. So if we're worrying about these guys that aren't going to employ two or three people, but the ones that employ 15 or 20 and hopefully 50, it turns out that it's actually harder to serve them than it is to serve the individual illiterate person who's trying to get a sewing machine in most countries.
I see what you mean. It's interesting.
So how do we do that?
Well, how do we really scale this? I can only speak from the lens of an organization that is an organization that needs to justify its disruptive innovation, which requires a certain amount of very limited smart subsidies that's out there, and impact investment dollars. And I'd say there are two key things. One, what mousetrap do you choose to build? What sandbox do you choose to play in where you're going to have the maximum impact? And I personally believe that the sandbox we're in, which is kind of the confluence of two powerful forces, is one of the, if not the most important place to play, which is A, small and growing businesses that I think are our greatest hope to drive economic growth, job creation, and environmental sustainability, and that if they have access, you know, businesses, as you say, are operating one or two levels up from microenterprise that might employ 50 or 500 people or serve, if they had access to capital and managerial talent and network knowledge and markets and so on, they can transform much of Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and beyond. So that's one piece. The other piece is agriculture. And microfinance is at a very difficult time getting to rural areas, not to mention remote rural areas, because it's really an urban and a peri-urban model based on very dense urban populations where you can cover your costs by having one investment officer covering 200 or 500 clients. agriculture, according to the World Bank, is, you know, agricultural growth is four times more effective in reducing poverty than growth in any other economic sector. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind. So I think the confluence of small and growing businesses together with agriculture and the impact that can have on base of the pyramid, BOP producers, where those producers link to new markets and in particular markets that reward differentiated products, will truly move the needle in terms of creating wealth and true poverty reduction in the areas that's needed most. And again, in the context of where do you justify such limited government aid and philanthropic capital, I think that's one of the key things. Lastly, really quickly, what's your theory of change? And in our case, the theory of change is to say, okay, we are going to build off-the-shelf banking products and market knowledge so that financial institutions recognize market opportunities in the countryside, adopt and enhance what we're doing over time, and then you thus kickstart a private market. And only by doing that will you unlock the motherload of capital, and not just capital, entrepreneurship, creativity, expertise that lies in the private markets.
Gustavo?
We have a number of windows through which we provide loans to small and micro, medium-sized enterprises as well, including the Inter-American Investment Corporation, which has lent over the last 25 years about $3.3 billion to directly or indirectly to over a million companies. Recently in Colombia, there was this was actually fairly innovative because it was financed by a local bond offering in local currency, the proceeds of which were placed with about five financial leasing companies, and they in turn, through their networks, we're not going to know, you know, who are those entrepreneurs, but we work with local agencies or entities that do. They were able to provide financial products, primarily through financial leasing, to over 1,000 companies in Colombia, and provided loans that range from $170,000, you know, equivalent in local currency, to $1 million. And those are, I think, the kinds of loans that I think you're talking about.
Yeah. So, thank you all for letting me guide this conversation for the first hour. Let me now turn it over to you to see if you have any questions for the panel. The gentleman in yellow, if you could say who you are as you ask the question.
Don Spiro, Bethesda, Maryland. In earlier discussions in this conference, there's been a lot of highlighting of the fact that small loans or even grants given to women have a profoundly different effect than if they're given to men. Whole sessions on that. I didn't hear that gender issue mentioned at all. I notice the gender of the panel. I'm just curious if this matters as an overlay to the really interesting topics you're all discussing.
Yeah, great question.
60% of our loans in Banco Azteca are for women. Natural selection, I have to say. It's not that we have a special program for that. But in Mexico, there's a very successful organization called Compartamos, and doing a quite good job, market-based, no subsidy. And their specialty is getting teams of 10 to 20 women together in a solidarity loan, which is a very interesting model, which now we are going to roll out also in our Banco Azteca system. Very, very interesting. So,
Willie?
So, excellent question. We are in the midst right now of launching what we call a women-centered initiative, where it's very interesting. When you look at agriculture, let's take Africa, 80% of actual farm work in Africa is done by women. And yet when you think agriculture, you think largely men. And
that's
often
true in most places underdeveloped. The women do all the work.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody.
I'm just sticking to the topic.
So it's a challenge and a wonderful opportunity in disguise for an organization that largely is about ag lending. To say, how do you, we have about 20% of our portfolio is naturally totally women-dominated enterprises. So like shea butter producers in northern Ghana are all women. And we just made a loan to the Liberian Women Sewing Project, which are all women in an ethical garment industry. And they're forward selling all their production to Prana, which is a hip yoga-inspired apparel company. Handcraft producers in the Andes, et cetera. But for the other 80% of the portfolio, I think the critical thing is to not be naive and romantic about I'm going to come in, I'm going to ring fence the women, I'm going to try to you know, empower those women within the business, but rather how do you create a much more inclusive, gender inclusive business and bring the men along? And are there ways, and something we're thinking seriously about, are there ways to actually economically incent an organization? We have a scorecard, ladies and gentlemen, and it's a scorecard that is on environment, yes, and it's on financial, and it's on human capital, which includes gender inclusion. Why? Because half the talent in this country are women. And if you guys are excluding the women to rise up within the management and their accountants and their head of sales and their managers, not to mention the producers, the women should be card-carrying co-op members in addition to the men. I think we have a very important role to play there, but it's not a no-brainer because you come in and you're dealing with very entrenched, multi-generational behavioral patterns. And again, if you cook up your idea from D.C. or Brussels as to how that should play out, you're probably going to go wrong, but it's an absolutely critical question.
Can I just add something anecdotally? I began the bank in December of last year, and I think it was the first or second project that I saw was in Bolivia. And one of the things that caught my eye was when the project leader described it, said something like, you know, 80 or 90% of the loans we made to women. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. And then about a week later, so another project, I forget which country it was like they announced 70% will go to women. And so I had a staff meeting, and I thought, you know, this is fantastic. They're really signaling, you know, women, empowering them, as we had said. And they said, no. It's just that they're the ones who actually pay back the loans, unlike men do. And so there is that kind of track record, and that's kind of bias that we have also at the bank.
Ricardo.
Very quickly. Remember that in most countries around the world, even in this country, most businesses, small businesses, are family businesses. So the role of the women in the family business, we have found, even if it's the men who are the face of the business, usually it's the women who's managing a lot of this family business. And in Agora's case, 45% of the entrepreneurs that we deal with are women-led. But of the other 65%, more than 80% of those are family businesses where the woman plays an integral part in the development of the business. So our new fund, which we're raising a $10 million fund to invest in SGBs in Central America, we want it to be the fund with the highest proportion of women-led businesses because they're self-selecting and because we have seen the management capacity of these women to grow.
Can I just say, a couple days ago, there was an example given of money given to a woman in, I think, Pakistan, whose husband was a drunkard. She built her business and then eventually hired him. She built her business and then hired him to do the deliveries because he could do that. That was the only thing he could do, but he got employed too because she was successful.
I hope he wasn't drunk and driving. next question. The gentleman here in the second row.
My name is Sergio Fernandez de
Cruz. Sergio, espérame un momento, por favor.
Sergio Fernandez de Cordoba. I was born in Peru. I live in New York now. I have multiple businesses and involved in a lot of entrepreneurial organizations globally. And just one of the things that I thought you guys did not touch on, which is right now there's a generational shift going on. There's a cultural shift going on. And education is lacking in the entrepreneur space. I started my first business when I was 12. And I did it on my own. But I forever looked for resources until I finally found resources when I was 23, which allowed me to sort of educate and learn and help continue to grow my business. Now, if you look at, you know, Latin America or even the rest of the world, nobody's really embracing education where it is at sort of the younger level and educating because it's all about the culture. If you're educating somebody about entrepreneurism, not business, but about being an entrepreneur, the different challenges and the resources, then I think what you're doing is creating generations of entrepreneurs rather than just focusing on the top 5% who are in need of this money because you're sort of missing, you're creating generational gaps.
Okay. So where is education today, and is it reflected in not just the highest levels but down at the sort of younger people and people who wouldn't necessarily have access to this?
A couple of things. I mean, there's wide-ranging studies that show that children of entrepreneurs tend to be more entrepreneurial. So as we attack and create an entrepreneurial culture today, you build in an ecosystem. I mean, in all over Central America, there's an association of young entrepreneurs, which are college and post-college students who are specifically receiving entrepreneurship courses, et cetera. And we've tried to work with the government, with the Ministry of Education, to put entrepreneurship into the middle school curriculum. They feel at this point that while that's good, it's not where their first priority is. So there are other organizations like TechnoServe and like the National Foundation for Teaching Entrepreneurship that is trying to scale some programs locally and embed them in the culture.
Ricardo.
I started by saying that to have a long-term sustainable productivity, you need to have three things. Number one was human capital. Number two, good environment. Number three, money capital. So human capital, of course, is health and education. And the sad thing is we always hear these huge numbers being invested by our governments in health and education. So why are we so screwed up? Again, it's a lack of accountability, the inefficiency, gross inefficiency. In my country, in Mexico, the government has never spent more than in education today. And what are the results? Pathetic. Pathetic. So I didn't mention it, but we also have something called Fundación Azteca, which is tuned to social causes. One of the programs of Fundación Azteca is called ASMAS, A-S-M-A-Z. ASMAS, it's an acronym for Asociación del Empresario Azteca. Well, what that tries to do is two things. First, it has some courses that we put together through third parties and ourselves, what it means to be a businessman, an entrepreneur. And it's online and it works, doesn't it? And then it also has a supply of goods that can be of capital goods that you can buy through the Electra chain of stores, goods that are targeted for productive uses. And it could be very simple things, like an industrial refrigerator for a restaurant, like a thing to raise a car and make a, you know, change the wheels. So those kinds of capital goods, which are rather difficult to get if you're out in some town, you can source through the supply chain. So those are the things that we are doing on the human capital side, but there's a lot more to do. And one has to start by questioning, what is the role of government spending in education? Or what are they doing with all that money? You know, paying all these bureaucrats.
Willie, I know you wanted to.
So, Cedric, this is a great question. I would proffer that one of the crown jewels of the U.S. society is that we have a plethora of technical colleges, of training institutes, of community colleges, SBA training, ways for working class to bootstrap them up and get those workforce skills under their belts. You don't have that, as you note, in many Latin American countries, not to mention in rural areas, and you don't have it in most of Africa, et cetera. So you have, yes, NGOs that can innovate disruptively, like a TechnoServe and others, and how do you create, training and education that's appropriate for those different demographics. But one thing I would, just since you're from Peru, I think a really important thing about small and growing businesses is that they can create the entrepreneurial fabric and conditions for other people to not only learn skills but to see it and kind of be inspired by that. So just an example, an anecdote. So in Peru, around Cusco, within 3, 4, 5 hours walk from Cusco, there's an organization called COCLA, which is a federation of farmer cooperatives. We started financing, they're largely Quechua. We started financing them probably 7 years ago. At the time, we were financing exports of coffee to all sorts of specialty buyers in the U.S. and Europe. About 4 years later, they started diversifying into cocoa. Not coca, cocoa. In the lower altitude areas. Then about 2 years ago, we got a credit request from them for $280,000, a five-year loan for what? For a animal feed processing plant. Why? They wanted to buy surplus grain grown at the 2 to 3 acre, farm household level by their members, of which each member had a little bit of surplus, and they're doing small animal husbandry. They wanted to buy that grain from them, enrich it into pelletized animal feed, on the one hand sell it back to their membership profitably, but at a very reasonable price for them so they could turbocharge their animal husbandry and increase protein and food security. And then on the other hand, they turned around and started competing with the private folks in COCLA, in Cusco in the supermarkets with their own branded product, COCLA Vita it was called. And then finally they did large-scale poultry production right there. That is entrepreneurship that nobody taught them how to do that, but you had a business that over 10, 15 years grew, and they said, I'm not going to be a one-trick monkey based on my cash crop export. I'm going to reinvest those earnings
into an agricultural industrial base in the middle of nowhere, 7 hours in Quillabamba, 7 hours south of Cusco.
That's a great story.
Isn't that a good story?
More questions?
Perhaps I should take time after the meeting if you could stay around. I want to tell you a story of social entrepreneurship that's going on in my home state of Oregon. I'm Al Jubitz, and it has to do with the environment. But I think a part of my objective in the next 20 years is to make it work for human services in the area of domestic poverty. The U.S. has 22% of people living in poverty.
I agree.
And so we this is the invisible nation. We call it the invisible nation. But under the, I have so much on my mind, I want to tell you how they did it, using an NGO to cut through 85% of government red tape. The story includes a spontaneous call. The CEO of this nonprofit was talking to the Department of Agriculture, went back to his hotel room, was going to go to the ball game, got a phone call. This is the White House. We want you to come over. And so the Obama administration is very aware of this new approach to getting things done efficiently. I want to tell that story to you. It's probably too much for here. But another thought, kind of departing from that thought. I'm cognizant that when we have bad things going on in the world, we're starting to create markets to reduce them. Think carbon, the price of carbon, carbon markets to combat climate change. Think green tags to combat energy inefficiency. The same story that I told you about is now trying to create a market for clean water. We had a water conference last night. I'm wondering if you could monetize poverty. You know, the reduction of poverty creates marketable things that would be used to build schools or some other social benefit. And I don't know if anyone on a macro scale has thought about, I'm told the United Nations, I think it's UNDP, knows how to eradicate poverty.
So, this product here, From Farmers to Farmers, Starbucks, is in effect monetizing poverty because they're selling a product where you as a consumer with all sorts of choices saying, I want to make a vote in an economic ballot box. I'm going to pay a little bit more, or at a minimum, I'm going to buy this product versus something else because I feel like I'm playing a role in building better livelihoods for African farmers in this case. To me, it's probably kind of a tawdry way to talk about it, but you're monetizing poverty in a way that I think actually is an innovation in the 21st century.
And indeed, there are actually efforts to even take it further. In the UK in particular, they're trying to create bonds that will pay off if they're actually able to reduce recidivism. So organizations are emitting bond, nonprofits, getting funding, and it is dependent upon, or the payoff which they will receive is dependent upon whether or not they actually reduce the recidivism rate, and the payout depends upon how much they do it. So there are actually, you know, innovative ways of trying to use market-based approaches to try to address some of the poverty issues.
Who's on the opposite side of that trade?
Investors, theoretically. And you've got government that are guaranteeing it. Yeah.
Hi, Shelley Porges with the State Department, leading an initiative called the Global Women's Business Initiative, a new effort that I had a chance to chat with Ricardo Terán about it the other evening. I appreciate Mr. Spiros' question about women, as that's what we're, one of the couple of things we're trying to focus on. I want to tell you about a couple of initiatives and then ask you a question. We have just launched at the Presidential Summit on Entrepreneurship 2.5 months ago. We announced the launch of a global entrepreneurship program, initially as an outreach to the Muslim world, but Mr. Salinas, perhaps you are aware or you'll be happy to hear that our next country is Mexico. And our intent there, we've launched it in Cairo, we're about to launch it in Indonesia. And we have assembled partners on the ground, public-private partnerships, that will fulfill each of six elements of that entrepreneurs need, from the identifying the high-potential, high-growth entrepreneurs to providing them with mentors, guiding them to finance, et cetera. You know, it will be a while to see how well we do, but we're very excited about the parties that have come on board to participate with us. So just want to let you know about that. In terms of the Global Women's Business Initiative, in addition to participating with these global entrepreneurship programs and bringing women into those environments, one of our other lead pieces is, in fact, integrating them into the global economy through an organization, another nonprofit called We Connect International, which has lined up over 200 American multinationals, including the obvious Walmarts and Coca-Colas of the world and whatever, to commit to doing business with certified women-owned businesses. And we connect both the technical training as well as the certification so that when they get certified, they know there's a market on the other side. And there are some really exciting variations on the theme I won't take your time now to tell you about. But our next, we're looking to do an initiative actually in Lima next, a pilot for this in Lima. So I'm interested in knowing from you, what was your best way of identifying the women's networks that, you know, that were most productive on the other side? You know, we talk about women not often having access networks, yet women entrepreneurs have often formed their own effective entrepreneurial networks. I'm curious how you all in your work have identified the most productive women's networks there.
Great. So given the time, let me ask the panelists if they want to respond to this question, please do so, and then I'll allow each of you to sort of have a final comment if you have a final point that you want to make. Ricardo.
You know, we have a scorecard of how we rate and identify businesses, and like Willie, it doesn't, you know, give you more points or less points if you're a woman or not a woman. But, you know, Central America is a small place. We've been able to network with all the business associations, and eventually some women associations come to us, and then in other cases we've been able to go to women. But we have helped a lot of these organizations incorporate more business thinking internally so that many of their programs could be geared towards getting their women investor ready or more bankable. And in that, you know, we have found financial partners on the ground that have dedicated time and resources to helping them do that.
Willie?
I'd say in our case, a fundamental principle that is kind of embedded in your remark is if corporates are looking to do business with women entrepreneurs and women-centered enterprises in developing countries, then that is a fundamental shift away from, in a complementary way, from the moral imperative, maybe half the sky, of empowering women to the economic rationale, that what's the bottom line effect of this, and it's actually very positive. And that's really critical, and I think that's where it gets much more into the mainstream of, you know, a global economy. In our case, I think it goes back to my comment about vertical investments versus horizontal integration of those investments in international development and business development. We have a model that basically works across any number of value chains across the world. And so we're able to basically hunt and peck across value chains, probably 25 different products now, and identify just through our transactional work the best in breed women-centered businesses. Or in the case of Nicaragua, which I've never understood why this is, and then maybe it's the Sandinista revolution, like virtually every single key co-op that we finance there are run by these incredibly charismatic women. And we find them simply by doing transactional work and kind of a dignified exchange of service between us and them and the value chain partners that they have. Do you want us to make our final
call? While you still have the floor.
While I'm on a roll, I guess all I would say is I think that the traditional aid and charity system is not fundamentally broken. I think we need to press the reboot or the reset button to make it so that it is providing the critical, grease in the wheels of the private sector. I think that's the single most important role that it can play, and be robust about it. It's both individual businesses with the market failures that they face. It's also those externalities and other things. And it's a sticky wicket, and it's not totally clear, I think, in anybody's heads how you do that. But to the fact that you have all these folks up here on this panel, and you know the work of the MIF and the IDB, I think that's the key, is to figure out how do we press the reboot button and work together with aid, charity, and private sector.
So. Yeah, I really can't add much more to that. In terms of women's issues, we do have a women's initiative through the Multilateral Investment Fund, and that's something, again, where it's because of moral imperative that Willie spoke about, as well as for economic efficiency reasons, it just makes a lot of sense. Because otherwise, as Willie said, you're cutting out 50% of the population. This doesn't make any sense. And we do so, again, locally, working through our local offices. And more than happy to put you in touch with people at the MIF and locally in Lima who can help you with that initiative.
Well, if we want to grow productivity on a long-term basis, as I said, human capital, meaning education and health, good environment, much less regulation, much simpler regulation and infrastructure, money capital in the form of lending and investment, but also very important, I'm going to quote here from the famous philosopher Santayana, elegir es renunciar. To choose is to renounce. And we need to make a choice. If we really want to make this growth in long-term productivity, we need to focus on that. And what that means is we need to renounce on another item that has been dragging down Latin America, especially Mexico, Central America, and some South American countries, which is this war on drugs. It's a whole other subject, but I have to mention it because it's incredibly costly, incredibly inefficient, no results, and incredibly distractive for our governments. And unfortunately, all our governments are tied down in this war on drugs. They're not thinking about the incredible things that need to be done in education, in infrastructure, in healthcare, and so forth. So we should stop prohibition, treat that drug addiction as a health issue, an educational issue, not a criminal issue. And that's a whole other subject.
Apparently, you're president for a day. What would you do?
Stop prohibition. Americans were very smart. They did prohibition in the 20s, realized it was a mistake, and changed prohibition in 1933. Give away the drugs for free. It's a drug, it's a health problem.
So let me give Bill Duggan and Glenn Hubbard the last word, which kind of understates everything we said. They write in their book, The Aid Trap, simply that only business creates the jobs that pull people out of poverty. It is the only reliable path to mass prosperity the world has ever known. So our organization, the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs, is dedicated to trying to pull together a network of organizations that believe that and are making it happen. I now want to thank you all for listening to kind of this perspective. A number of the panel are going to go and be available for further questions at the Coke tent after this and around lunchtime. So if you're interested in these topics, I encourage you to come out and visit with us then. But for now, I hope that you will join me in thanking Ricardo, Willie, and Gustavo for a great panel.